Welcome to Conservative Patriot Nation, new members and returning members. Tonight we have a fantastic patriot and a fantastic guest, a man that served in the military from the lands down under, Lieutenant Colonel Ricardo Bozzi. Before we get to the show, I'd like to recognize a couple of our sponsors, MyPillow and Mike Lindell, a guy that's been in the forefront of this fight. The man has been investing a lot of his time, a lot of his money, and he's really been out there exposing the deep state and trying to restore and save the republic. So if you go to MyPillow.com and use promo code CPNN, you can get up to 66% off your purchase. And last but not least, I'd like to recognize another patriot, Dr. Zelenko, the late great. During the time of crisis, he was saving a lot of lives to where the enemy, the evil enemy, was trying to shut him down from helping people, but that didn't stop him. And it didn't stop him as he's not with us anymore. So if you go to zstacklife.com, you'll see some great, awesome products. And use promo code CPN, you'll get up to 5% off your purchase. And now with further ado, Ricardo Bozzi, thank you for joining us tonight.
Absolute pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you for your kind invitation.
So it's been a while since we had you on. How have things been going over there? I'm sure it's pretty crazy like it is over here.
Oh, yeah. We've been watching the acceleration of the reveals, which we've been warning everybody, pay attention. As the pace picks up, it means we're getting closer to the final phases. And I think it was in October, November last year, I warned people out the first quarter would be a bit rough, and then it would start to accelerate, and then the major players would start to fall. And we've had a plethora of our state premiers, which is like your state governors, resigning for no apparent reason. Health ministers have resigned, chief medical officers have resigned, and this is the beginning of the fall that we're very excited about, because we know it's accelerating, we know the truth is coming out. We are winning and they are losing. That's the simplest way. So for those of us who are aware of what's going on, we're very excited. We're very busy too, because we know that our primary role will kick off once we have won the victory. Others will have won the war for us. And then we have the, what do they call those, Herculean labors of peace to turn this country into what it can be.
Yeah, we've been seeing some very much similar things with a lot of people resigning, and there's just so much going on. I mean, it seems like every time they're trying to attack Trump, before you know it, now they're increasing the talks of impeaching Biden. So it's like moves and counter moves, and it's pretty wild.
I was just going to say, watching the moves against President Trump, it's not unlike many battles in history. When you watch it from a distance, you think, my goodness me, what's going on here? But they keep leading them into traps, and the cabal the cabal keeps following the bait. It's just funny. I mean, they're catching fish without putting a worm on the hook, although they need it, and that's the president. He's been doing a stellar job in drawing the adversary into traps. As you know, the indictment, the search of Mar-a-Lago, all setting a precedent now for every other president prior to President Trump to have exactly the same done to them. And from this will be the means by which the disclosure can be made public. Now, we assume the president's Trump team have all the data and the information, but it's got to be revealed in a way that's digestible for the greater public. And the logic has to be sound. The precedent has to be there. They had the shock and horror of the attacks on Trump, which he bore with great equanimity. And the shock of the new has been experienced by the people. And this is important in the psychology of moving forward. The shock of the new has been dealt with, and now they'll think, well, this happened before, so it can happen again. The first one is always difficult, whether it's a new idea, it's a new concept, it's a new technology. The first one is picked up by what they call the early adapters, but the great mass of the market will get there after it's been proven. And now it's been proven, they will accept with great ease investigations and indictments to do with, and you can go back through every president that's still living. And so it's been fun for us to watch.
I agree totally, and I'm glad you kind of went on that subject, because I had a question for you. Folks are still complaining that they aren't seeing enough progress, and it feels like it's because they lack the knowledge of the fifth, sixth, and seventh generation of warfare. Can you please touch on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. But the answer, I'll get to that very quickly, but the evidence is out there. If you don't know what you're looking for, then you won't see it. The second point is, I remind people, remember what it was like a year ago. Remember what it was like 2 years ago. Remember what it was like 3 years ago. We have moved so rapidly. And think about it. The adversary we are fighting has been in this position for a long time. By a long time, depending on how you wish to measure it, it could be decades, centuries, or millennia. And so to dislodge an enemy in such a short time frame, and as we know by way of background, this last counteroffensive, which will be successful, kicked off in 63 with President JFK's death. And it really took on a serious tone there. So this has been a 60-year war, and it'll be 60 years this year. So that, just to get in context for people who can't see enough, these are people generally who have never had, and it's not a criticism, it's just a fact. People have never worked in a large, complex organization that understands systems and the subtleties of movement and the time issues take. I mean, if you run a corner store, you run the store, you make a decision, it's executed within a few minutes. You know, if you're married and you've got a wife or a husband, you know decisions take a whole lot longer than if you're on your own. But the scope, scale, and complexity of this is so vast, so great, that these things take time. And again, it's not a criticism, but those who have never been involved in large, complex organizations comprising tens of thousands of individuals and systems, these things take time, particularly when you're now penetrating a well-entrenched enemy. So having said that, let's talk about five, six generational warfare. A quick recap. Generations of warfare are used by academics to describe the progression of the tactics, techniques, and procedures and the equipment and the systems used by military since Cain killed Abel. So he picked up a rocket, smashed it into his brother's head and killed him. Well done. That's, you know, first-gen warfare. First-gen warfare is simply massed troops beating the living daylights out of each other at close range, supported, of course, with things like down the track bows and arrows and catapults. But by and large, the victory is won by the numbers. Occasionally, a good commander could take a smaller number of groups and use offensive or defensive tactics to his or her advantage. But by and large, it was mass troops beating each other with swords. Second-gen warfare is being the example of it was trench warfare, but that's not actually what it was. Trench warfare, World War One. What led to trench warfare? That was a consequence of the lethality range, and was a third element of it, of distance weapons, like, for example, catapults and bows and arrows, they're very short range. But when technology got to the point where they had cannon that could fire many miles, they had machine guns that could put rounds down range at several hundred a minute, thousands a minute, the response to that was dig in, because that's all they could think of, because they hadn't managed to bring together the elements which existed at the time, and I'll talk about that in a minute too. But trench warfare wasn't a choice. It was a necessity. The range and lethality of these distance weapons, rifled weapons, as I said, the machine guns and the cannon, that compelled the opposing forces to take strong defensive measures, which was to dig into trenches. And they would stay in trenches for months at a time without moving. And so they used the trench warfare as second-gen warfare. But what it was we don't know what else to do. Because the way it was fought until the very end, the way it was fought was still first generation. Let's send thousands of lads over the top after pummeling the enemy with cannon. And the trouble with that is it turned the battlefield into a quagmire that provided cover in terms of shell holes, but it made it nearly impossible sometimes for the troops to advance. But that was a necessity. What happened was, and it was the greatest general of World War One without question, certainly the greatest general on the Allies side, the one who's potentially being discussed as a replacement for Field Marshal Douglas Haig, who was the senior Brit general. And that was Sir John Monash. He was an Australian. And Monash was an extraordinary character. He's on our $100 bill. He's probably the least known of all the characters in Australia because military generals don't figure largely in Australian history, but Monash was the first, and I'll tell you why this happened. He was the first general to be knighted on the field of battle by a British monarch in 200 years. He was actually knighted during World War I. And what happened was he was the first to shift into understanding and applying third gen warfare, which is maneuver. Because what had happened was instead of having horsed cavalry, they now had tanks and armored cars. They had the machine guns, as I said. They had aircraft. So you had a third dimension to the battlefield now being aircraft in a vertical dimension, not just left or right and up and down. And so Monash was the first one to learn to synchronize and coordinate his battles using all these new elements. And this was the introduction of third generation warfare of maneuver. And he was a citizen soldier, actually. He was an engineer and a lawyer, but also what you would call a National Guard or a militiaman. But he had, unlike most reservists who turn up as best they can, he committed his life to military, the study of military tactics and weaponry, and developed in conjunction with another gentleman a pop-up machine gun, for example. He actually gave a talk to the Royal Military College. He gave a presentation to the Royal Military College, I think 1902, 1903, very early in the new century in Australia, about the future of warfare, how it would be dominated by machines and aircraft. And this must have been after Kitty Hawk, but he gave a talk very futuristic, how warfare would be dominated by machines, and the key was to synchronize these new capabilities. He was laughed at as a loon. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And a few short years later, there he was putting it together. And his battles were actually synchronized to the minute. And he got cranky if it took 2 or 3 minutes longer than he planned. But that General Sir John Monash. So this was the beginning of third gen warfare, which is maneuver warfare. Then that was the tone for the end of World War I under Monash, World War II certainly, and then after that as well, maneuver warfare, third gen. Fourth gen, and this is asymmetrical warfare. This is non-government groupings now playing a role, because significant effort had gone into developing rules for the Geneva Convention and the Hague Convention, and there's a reason for it. It seems like lunacy, you know. It's like putting speed limits at a racetrack. But the trouble is, unless you have rules for war, it degenerates quickly into total war, and nobody likes total war, and we are experiencing that now, and I'll speak to that in a moment. So we had maneuver warfare, third-gen warfare, which drifted into the asymmetrical warfare, terrorism, and if those of you old enough, you'll remember the rise of the terrorist groups, Black September, hijacking aircraft. This is fourth-gen warfare. This is now fighting... Geneva Convention war. And so, excuse me for a minute, I've just got to shut the door, otherwise you'll hear the family shenanigans in the...
No worries.
And we're back. So, fourth gen warfare, asymmetrical, terrorist groups, non-state actors. And there's a context to that too, there's a lot to this. Fifth gen warfare now is... Excuse me. Fifth gen warfare is non-kinetic by and large. That's what's described as non-kinetic. We're not talking about just delivering lumps of copper-jacketed metal to the adversary. And you'll find that definitions that it includes things like social engineering, misinformation, cyber attacks, and emerging technologies. And that's true to an extent. But the major part of it is the fact that it's highly automated with AI, robotics. And there's another element to it, and this is the social engineering part, and it's not new. It's always been part of warfare, but it's the subtlety with which not only what we think, but how we think. And this is the subtle part of the fifth gen warfare. The obvious part, what in the old days was called propaganda, has always been there to engender in both the population, the home population, and the adversary, a certain mindset. And so that's always been there. What's different now is they're actually using new technologies to do it. And so that's the fifth gen warfare, robotics, emerging technology, AI, what you think and how you think, not just what, but how, because they've been getting into our heads through basically a very sophisticated MK Ultra approach through TV, movie, and the rest of it. So not just the data, that they have persuaded whole populations to a new way of thinking, to reject certain things and accept other things. Now, this is total war in its simple definition, where there is no home population, there is no forward edge of the battle area, there is no area of operations. The world is the area of operations. The TV set is the area of operations. The movies are the area, the radio, you name it, all of it. So that's fifth gen. So before I get on to sixth, now let me just wrap that up and show you where this continuity. Firstly, as I said, it's an academic definition. Soldiers don't necessarily use it. We use it to understand it, but unless it has a practical application, we don't much care. But it's an interesting thing. But all elements have been there the whole time, even in first gen warfare, where they try to persuade populations of certain facts the wrong way. Propaganda has been there the whole time. But what's also been there the whole time, so that people understand that this is not these separate steps, one leading to the next. We know that the cabal, we know that malevolence has been operating this, directing this war. And let's just keep it really simple. Let's not go back 2,000 years. Let's go back 100 years. The control of the creation of the Fed, for example, that's a form of economic warfare. That's been part of it. That's been part of war. The control of the media and the concentration of the media, and it was just recently, it was six corporations controlled all the news and entertainment, or 90% of the news and entertainment. It's now four corporations controlling the news and entertainment. And if you think that you have come to the conclusion that you have because the media has given you facts, you've made up your own mind, you're deluding yourself. You've been brainwashed, like all of us. So all of these elements have always been there, what we think and how we think. This has been going on since the beginning. So once again, I'm trying to clarify for people, this is nothing new. There are new elements, and we talk about that shortly, but this is nothing new. These elements have all been there. The kinetic part has developed without a shadow of a doubt, but the softer elements, the non-state actors and the rest, these people have been controlled. Now, don't shoot me, I'm just a piano player, but the evidence is coming out, and I'll show you the resource that was sent to me recently. For example, this confirms a lot of ideas that are out there. Excuse me, I'll get that right in a second. There we go. This is a three-volume record of the interrogation of Heinrich Müller, conducted in 1948 by the U.S. Müller was the head of Gestapo. He allegedly died. He didn't. He went off to Switzerland and eventually worked for the USA, met the U.S. president. So how about that? So the same people have been at the top level of the US government and the British government and all the other governments since the war. FDR's cabinet was penetrated by Soviet spies, including his vice president. And there's evidence there of that. A massive penetration by the Soviets of FDR's cabinet during World War II. And that evidence was provided to Roosevelt. He did nothing about it. So what I'm saying is, as unpalatable a law as this is, and if you find that unpalatable, the next couple of months are going to blow your minds, because Australia's, you know, as bad as any other country. All these non-kinetic elements have been there the whole time. So when we talk fifth gen warfare, and we're talking about how you think and what you think, this has been going on since forever. The whole century has been controlled by the same group. So we have to understand that when, for example, we shifted to asymmetrical warfare in fourth gen warfare with terrorist groups, this was allowed to happen. This was intended to happen. It's like the rise of ISIS under Obama. I sat there as a military professional, as did anybody else, and watched the screens. And at first, before I understood it, I'd say, what the hell are you letting this happen? This is so easily solved. I mean, seriously, this is not hard stuff. Why are you allowing it to occur? And then I thought, that's it. They're allowing it to occur. So asymmetrical warfare wasn't an accident or a development by necessity. It was established and set up by the cabal. And the evidence was there, for example, with ISIS. I know this is a very long answer to a very short question, but unless we understand this at a deep level, we'll continue to be confused. But for example, ISIS, how are they making money? Because these things cost, wars cost money. That's it. If you've got the biggest bag of gold, you get the biggest army, you win. It's pretty straightforward. So how was ISIS able to develop so quickly? Quite apart from the political cover it got, where was the money coming from? Well, allegedly, they were selling oil through Turkey. What, really? They had sophisticated passport production and the rest of it. So we're not talking, and careful, I'm going to use this word intentionally. It's an offensive word. A bunch of ragheads are running an entire economy? Are you kidding me? It wasn't. It was a very sophisticated operation run by people who knew how to do it. The cabal, the deep state, was running this on behalf, and they threw up this asymmetrical group, this ISIS, as some unbeatable foe. And they even had the videos of the Toyota Land Cruisers driving down the road as if, here's our victory parade, see how powerful we are, in the old Soviet style. And I just thought to myself, well, you know, a couple of squadrons of A-10s would take that out and put them back in their caves. And it wasn't happening because it wasn't supposed to happen because the cabal, the deep state, not the United States, created this monster like they created everybody else. Go back a little bit. Communist China was created. Your chief of staff at the time, George C. Marshall, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, sent a message to General Wiedemeyer, I think, who was running the Chinese area of operations during World War II, directed that Mao Zedong and his people should form half the post-war government. And Wiedemeyer said, you must be crazy. Mao Zedong's a thug. He's not a political leader or freedom fighter. This guy's just a criminal thug. And Wiedemeyer said, look, we've got to back the Taiwanese on this, not the communists. And George C. Marshall said no, and he stripped the Taiwanese of their weaponry and made sure the Chinese were 50% of the government, because the cabal, the deep state again, who have been controlling the whole planet, needed to create a counterpoint for US supremacy, and that was the Chinese and the Soviets. And so they created communist China for a purpose. The cabal, not the US, the cabal, the deep state, they created it. So you've got to understand, there's a bigger picture. It's not, you can't, if you get too close to the ground, you miss the big picture. And so when the fourth gen warfare, the asymmetrical warfare came up, it was just continuation of the same people making life bloody difficult for us. All of this could have been squashed in a minute. I don't know how many times I've heard, you know, soldiers, officers say, why won't they let us finish the last war properly? They always sow the seeds for the next war. It's not an accident, it's by design. And so we get into the fifth gen warfare, which, as I said, mainly non-kinetic. There's still major kinetic parts to it, and it uses all the skills and techniques and tactics of the previous generation of warfare. But it now includes not just what you think, which is the propaganda, but how you think, getting into our brains in such a way that we don't even know we're not thinking what we want to think. And that gives us the first five generations of warfare designed and exploited by the cabal and deep state. So now we get to sixth gen. Now, sixth gen warfare has been around since forever as well, but it's been weaponized more in a more sophisticated way, certainly for many, many decades. And it includes energy and consciousness. Now, I don't mean energy as in energy weapons. I mean energy, consciousness. And it comes in the form of, say, remote viewing. Now, some of you may have heard of remote viewing. It's been explored and used by the Soviets during the Soviet Union. It's explored and developed certainly by the Americans as well and other countries. And for those who don't know what remote viewing, and this is just one aspect, because every capability has an offensive and a defensive side to it. You must be able to deliver the effect. You must be able to protect yourself from the adversary who is doing the same to you. So, for example, in remote viewing, a set of coordinates can be given to a remote viewer, and you can, there's any number of them. Michael Jaco, for example, did it for CIA. You give them a set of coordinates, and research yourself, always do your own research, check it up. Set of coordinates, and the remote viewer will then go to that, doesn't even know where it is. Just a lat long, latitude, longitude, doesn't have to know on the planet where it is, but the consciousness will go there and then be told, go to the second floor, third room on the right. In the corner, there's a four-drawer filing cabinet. On the bottom drawer, in the third folio, there's a document there. Please tell us what's on that document, and they can do it. And this sounds like something out of a Marvel comic, but it is very real. I remember, I've told this story before, but it's instructive. I was a staff officer to one of the Brigadiers and Army Headquarters, Information Management. And I said to him, and this is a long time ago when I was a major, I said, sir, we should look into this remote viewing stuff. And he just looked at me and laughed, because he was a very straight-laced Christian where, you know, that sort of thing didn't exist. And I backed off and let it go. My argument being, if the US and the Soviets are looking into it, we should be looking into it too. And he just sort of waved off. That's how difficult it is to get into some people's heads. So if you find this challenging, I've got no problem with that. Just go do your own research. Don't dismiss it. Just do your research. But this is remote viewing. This is just one part. Six-gen warfare also includes, for example, the capacity to know what's going on in somebody else's mind. Now, as a military commander, the first thing you need is people. That's your first priority. The second priority is intelligence. You get the right people and the intel, then all of a sudden, you can do whatever you need to do. Now, even in our little organization here, we've been using this for some time. And if I need to know what's going on in somebody's head, I'll ask the team, plug into X and tell me what he or she is. How did they respond to this particular event? Because if I get into the commander's head, if I understand what they're thinking, how they're thinking, what their emotional state is, it helps me deploy my limited resources in the most effective way, which is a standard special ops way of doing business. We don't deploy, you know, battalions of soldiers. We'll send in a team or two. But that team has to hit a particular point that has a strategic effect on the whole battle. And so we've been doing that too. And so recently, an event occurred, and I said, right, how did he respond? In this case, it was he. How did he respond to that? And the world came back. He said, bullshit. And that was all I needed to hear, because I knew exactly what that meant and why it meant that. And so that helps me understand what's going on in the heads of my adversaries. And that allows us to fight our war with extremely limited resources. But for those who have been following me, I'll follow a certain path, and I'll just disappear and come back a week later and turn up somewhere else. And it's hard to follow. And that's by design. Once again, just letting you know, you never, old special ops objective, be overestimated, be underestimated, but never let them know your true capacity. Now, the fact I'm revealing this doesn't worry me in the slightest, because we're now at a point where it's okay. I wouldn't have said this 2-3 years ago. And I'm certainly not going to talk anymore in terms of our own capability and how far it goes. But six-gen warfare is that use of consciousness to achieve a strategic advantage over your enemy by understanding not just their disposition, their capabilities, but also the mind of the commander. And that is of immense value to an opposing general. If you know the mind of the commander, it's good to know where the troops are. It's good to know where the defenses are. It's good to know where the minefields are, to use a metaphor. But if you know their state of mind, how worried they are, how confident they are, how arrogant they are, how tired they are, what's keeping them up at night, that gives you a greater advantage than anything else. So that's six-gen warfare. Now, I'm not going to wrap up yet. I've got a couple. Let me give you an example. Everyone's capable of this sort of, with training, most people are capable of this. But let me give you an example of how to test yourself, what it feels like. And then I'll take a break and we'll go to questions. Wherever you're sitting right now, right, you know where you are. Just look around. And okay, like I'm sitting at my desk, I'm sitting in front of a laptop, I've got labs, books and stuff around. Now I'm going to imagine myself in that back corner where the A1 sign is. You see that sign? I'm going to put myself in that corner and look at myself from there, right? I can do that now in my imagination. And I can sit there and go, okay, I can see my back, I can see my head, I can see this guy sitting at a desk. Now where's my consciousness? Where am I? Am I at my desk or am I in the corner looking at myself? And if you find that fun, let's continue it. So I'm going to put myself back. I'm going to imagine I'm in that back corner looking at me in real time, in real time. And now I'm going to go to the other side of the room where you can see the Papua New Guinean wall hanging. And I am there. And I'm watching me near the A1 sign, watching me at my desk. So wait, I'll just get there. Yep. I'm watching me near the A1 sign, who's watching me at my desk. Now the question is, where's my consciousness? It's a lot of fun. What science has revealed is consciousness is a non-localized event, meaning we have a meat suit. Our consciousness is connected to this meat suit, but our consciousness is a non-localized event. And that's how this works. Now, this is extremely challenging for some people. And it's a very simple description of what is quite an elegant and beautiful capability, of which most of us have the ability to train for. But if you get that understanding that consciousness is a non-localized event, what it can allow you to do, it allows me now to send my consciousness and find out what's going on in the mind of an enemy commander. It also has a defensive capability where I can protect myself from penetration by someone with a similar intent. Does that make sense? And now we get into six-gen warfare. If you want an example of how this has been working forever, it's called prayer. And I use that word quite specifically. It's called prayer because there are countless examples throughout history of an intention being set and praying for, or visualizing, but more effectively praying for that to occur. And it happens because you're tapping into something else. And so this capacity for prayer or setting your intention, and again, I'll give you another example very, very shortly. Your intention has an impact on the real surroundings. Now, I think it was Washington, and I think it was the city of Washington. And it goes back, God, it's so long. Sorry, I'm going to have to dig into the archives of my brain to remember this particular event. But they wanted to test the power of meditation, prayer, consciousness, focus, concentration on a city to see if it could reduce crime. And so they picked Washington, the city of Washington, during the summer. And the goal was, let's reduce crime by pick a percent, you know, 1 or 2%. And they went to the local police chief and said, look, this is what we're going to do. We've got all these people around the planet. And it wasn't many, it was a few hundred. And we're going to intend that crime in Washington in summer drops by a couple of percent. And the police chief smiled and said, for that to happen, because you imagine Washington in summer, it's hot, it's stingy, the tempers flare, patience is gone, crime rates skyrocket. He said to achieve that in Washington in summer would be the equivalent of having 3 inches of snow land overnight, and everyone is just sitting at home because it's too cold to go outside and do anything wrong. So they did it, and it worked. They reduced the crime rate. Here's another example of six-gen warfare. It's quite extraordinary. Now, once again, the bad guys have been using this for some time. The good guys have been doing it as well. If you want to study more about that, you might want to investigate any book by Lynn McTaggart, L-Y-N-N-E McTaggart, who's written about this, not in the form of six-gen warfare, but the power of concentration, focus, meditation, and prayer, or intention, whatever you're going to call it, the intention experiment. And that's what you're tapping into. This is six-gen warfare, and it bleeds over into seven-gen warfare too, but this is what it is. But again, it's a very long answer, and I hope that's been helpful in terms of background, context, who's been controlling it, and why I'm so confident about the future and how it's going to unfold. Because if we get an entire population engaged in focusing on what they want rather than worrying about what's happening, then all of a sudden we can start to use that six-gen warfare capability to start manifesting it, and manifesting it in real time. That's why I spend so much time, not so much talking about what's gone wrong in the last couple of weeks and more evidence that, you know, COVID is nonsense and the jabs kill. We know that. I get frustrated. There's acres of information. I don't need any more information. This stuff's bad. What I focus on for Australia, because my responsibilities start and end here, Australia first, to put it another way, is to make sure that the people are focusing on what we're going to create. And that's why I talk about the constitutional convention we're going to have in 2024. The educative process that will precede the convention proper, and then we work through it. And so the more I get Australians thinking about that, even things like our new flag. Now, we're going to have a new flag. Why? Because we're going to need one, because by the time the truth comes out, nobody's going to want a connection with the old flag, I can tell you. As much as the Australian flag is loved by some and hated by others, and there are different versions of the Australian flag that people love, it'll all be washed aside. And so get them thinking about a new flag. Get them thinking about a new constitution. Get them thinking about a new Australia. And as they start focusing their consciousness and their attention on the future, and we start to bring together and coalesce a coherent picture of what we want to create, we are now using six-generation warfare to not only we're just out of the range of our adversaries, because we are not where they think we are. We're somewhere else, if that makes sense. So it's a very complex field. I hope that's been helpful. I'll stop talking now. You can pepper me with questions, but that's what's going on. That's what has been going on. All elements of all generations of warfare have existed simultaneously since Cain killed Abel, with absent maybe the technologies, because the technologies have assisted. And there's also a question or two you can ask about AI, the future of AI, and the importance of six and seven gen warfare to combat AI, because AI, to my mind, is the greatest threat that's facing life on Earth. So there you go. I'm sorry if that took so long. I hope it was helpful. I'll stop talking now and you can hit me with some questions.
No, you're good. I appreciate you for elaborating on the generational warfare, because it's important for people to hear. I was just listening to an interview earlier, and a speaker that we're going to be having on here, he was explaining on how the elite, the darkness, has been controlling consciousness. And in this awakening, with so many podcasters like this and many others that is bringing information out to the world, it's raising to a certain percent, which the darkness, they're in fear of that, because it's like that 100 monkey effect with consciousness. So you kind of touched on that very strong, and it's so true. And a lot of people need to hear that, because this is stuff that they kind of put in movies to where people look at it like, oh yeah, that's sci-fi. That happens. No. People don't realize how strong our consciousness is and that world that they haven't been allowed to see. So I thank you for everything that you shared on that.
If I might, very quickly, that you alluded to the 100 monkey effect. I'm not sure if people are aware of the origin of that expression, but there was a naturalist studying a band of monkeys, and there was one particularly intelligent female that discovered that by washing the potatoes, the sweet potatoes that they were digging out of the ground, by washing it in salt water, not only got rid of the mud, but the salt added to the flavor and was more palatable meal than just digging up the sweet potato and eating it right there, as you can imagine a monkey might do. Now, what was interesting was the naturalist noticed that the whole band of monkeys started following suit because they saw what the wise old woman was doing. That wasn't the clever part. The clever part, there's another band of monkeys some distance away that had no contact with this band, but they started doing the same thing just instantaneously. Because the consciousness of that particular, and there's a correct term for it. Anyway, the band of monkeys, tribe, no, what's it called? What's a collective noun for monkeys? I can't remember, I'm sorry. Anyway, the collective consciousness, that 100th monkey effect, leapt a physiological boundary, a distance, and entered the consciousness of another band of monkeys. And that's the origin of that. And that's the beauty of it. And what you're the point you're talking to is very critical. This is exactly what happens. The more you can focus your intention on what you want, the more difficult it is for malevolence to combat you or find you. You're not even in the same place, let's say. And you can interpret that as well. Because, and here's a metaphor, but it's quite accurate. Darkness is not something in and of itself. It's just a lack of something else. It's darkness is a lack of light. It's an old question that popped into my head a long time ago. I was staring at the TV, just mind in neutral, drinking soda and potato chips. And the question popped into my head, is light the lack of dark or is dark the lack of light? And I thought, where the hell did that come from? And then not long as I was pondering that question, it changed. Is evil the lack of good or is good the lack of evil? And once you start pondering these questions at a very deep level and understand its profound importance, because it has an impact on everything else on your worldview, you start to comprehend, okay, there's bigger things here. There are ways to win here. There's a new way to operate. There's a whole new place I can be. I'm not constrained by an either-or world.
Right. The biggest threat is information, and as long as people keep sharing information and educating those that people would call normies or sleep, they haven't been privileged of higher conversations like this, and the more that people have shows like this, the more they're going to see it, and they're going to go on their own. Some people, I need to tell my mom or my brother or my friend and share this. They're going to find it. It's just like that 100 monkey effect. As long as we keep producing and putting it out there, they're going to find it, and that's what a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, it's and what I love, because my gold standard for behavior is a guy called Jesus Christ. He's pretty good. And I grew up a Catholic, and I was an altar boy, and I did all of that. But even at age 9, I remember I was in fourth grade, and we'd do the catechism, and a lot of it didn't make sense. But whenever they spoke about key things that Christ said, it stuck like glue. But it has an impact to this discussion. Things like, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And he's on the cross, right? He's on the cross. Is experiencing the most painful death, so painful that when that it wasn't, crucifixion was such an awful, awful death that no Roman citizen could be crucified. And in 200 AD, when that limitation was lifted, the elites made sure that they could not be crucified. Didn't matter what they did, they could never be crucified. They might be sentenced to death, but it was decapitation. That's how bad it was. So here's this carpenter hanging from a cross in excruciating pain, because the flogging beforehand was sometimes enough to kill people. And he said, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. Now, what was the basis of that in the context of the discussion we're having right now? Instead of putting out anger and vitriol against his persecutors, he's done nothing to warrant this, he's not adding to their energy. He's actually creating more light in a world of absolute darkness. And that has an effect. That has an effect. Every time we forgive, it is a benefit to us, and it's a benefit to the person who's done the wrong act. Now, that doesn't mean they're gonna have their come to Jesus moment in this life. They're gonna have to wait to get to the other side, and they'll get it. But it's a positive contribution in terms of the consciousness of those around you to forgive in a very real way. It doesn't mean you don't punish. It doesn't mean you don't lock up. Let's not be naive about this. But the energy that we put into a situation, that dispassionate forgiveness to understand that they literally do not know what they're doing, is part of the six, seven gen warfare that is going to assist us to win. This is the one thing that we have that we can turn to our advantage. We really can.
Absolutely. And I got a couple things before we go into Q&A. What are you permitted to share about the current state of war around the world?
Oh, that's a big question. The best thing we can do is look at markers. Now, there's been a bunch of markers that we've all been waiting for and have occurred. You know, for example, London Bridge. This was the death of the Queen in England. We know that she was executed a couple of years ago, but for public consumption, she recently died. Excuse me. So we've been watching the markers. Now, what's the most recent marker that's of particular interest? I mentioned at the beginning President Trump's indictment, which is excellent. That's not so much a marker. That's a sort of a tactical indicator of what future intentions might be. But in terms of Australia, let's start down here. The fact that Don Jr. is coming to speak to Australia is a massive marker for those who want to know. Now, Australia's amazing. It's so many. Half the country's asleep's not the right word. But whatever they are, they're just unaware. They're still plugged into mainstream media. If it doesn't happen on mainstream media, it's not true. And so there's not a lot of awareness that he's coming in a larger sense. Amongst those who are aware, we're very excited, not just to hear what he's got to say, but the fact that the president will send his son to Australia to do a talk, a presentation and a talk to the Australians is a huge marker to say that we are close. So how's the war rolling out? How's it going? Man, if President Trump is sending Don Jr. down here, things are reaching their climax. Now, I indicated again in October, November last year that because I'm always pressed for a date. And like all of us, we're reluctant to give dates. But I knew back then, because it's an event-driven operation, not a time-driven operation, certain things have to occur in sequence. So if something takes a bit longer, that next objective is going to take time. But even then, I knew that by about July, August, and I phrased it this way, enough will have happened to have woken up most of the world. So how's the war going? In Oz, we're mopping up. There are still, you may have heard that there are more tunnels, more dumbs, deeper and more of them and longer than they anticipated. So that took a bit longer. But Don Jr. is coming, so we're okay. We're in the mopping up phases. There are most of the levels of control have been taken out. And now we're left with basically the people at the bottom and maybe one layer above them. So we've got the useful idiots and the slightly less idiotic but equally useless people giving them more. So you've got sort of the second graders telling the first graders what to do. Everybody else is gone. And so I'm quite confident. Now, people look at the obvious things and like, oh, well, they're still pushing the jab. Well, of course they're pushing the jab, but the jab is probably saline, so relax. Again, it's lack of experience in a large complex organization executing a large complex plan. What you are doing is not necessarily clear, and you won't be told what's clear, because if they tell you, then the bad guys know too. So we're in pretty good shape. The outside of Oz, and I haven't been paying a lot of attention, to be honest, so I'm reluctant to give too much information away. But I will say, for example, they're still ongoing. They're still mopping up. There will be all sorts of threats of world-ending events, which are all nonsense. It's what the cabal intended, but it will not be executed. But as far as Oz is concerned, we're in the final, but very brave men and women on our behalf, are in the final stages of mopping up. And you look at the markers, you can see that. So I'm quite confident, quite happy. They're doing the work that the soldiers need to do. And then we, as the people, have to do what the legislators have to do, because we are the legislators, and we have to soften the edges of that military victory, if that makes sense. So we're pretty relaxed and comfortable back here in Oz. For those of us who know, we're just getting on with the job, getting ready for this next phase.
Wow, that's awesome. Don Jr.'s coming down there. I got two more things for you, Bolzy, if that's okay.
Yep, go for it.
How has warfare changed since you first began your career in the military? And what is your plan for the future of the Australian military in particular?
Oh, man. Thank you for asking that. I get so excited about this because I can see it with great clarity. Okay. Since I first joined up, so I joined the military. I hadn't even turned 18, 1977. We're still in the shadows of the Vietnam War. My first platoon sergeant was a Vietnam vet. And he'd forgotten more about soldiering that I'd learned in my training. And it was just a privilege. And I'm going to make him famous. He's a great guy. Every young officer knows that if you crack it for a good sergeant, good platoon sergeant, you've got it made. And Warrant Officer Class 1, Col Sider. I'm not sure if he's around. I used to ring him up every couple of years just to thank him for his extraordinary guidance for this young, energetic, let's say, second lieutenant. He's a good man. And he retired in Newcastle. He's a good guy. And I'm grateful to him. In fact, I should give him a call. It's been a few years. So I grew up in the military in the shadow of Vietnam. A lot of jungle warfare, open warfare, mechanized warfare. We had to practice every form of warfare in order to make sure we knew how to do what we had to do. But it was very simple. It was the last of the simple times in military history because technology was rapidly advancing. I mean, the internet wasn't around. We used old 77 radios. We're still using M60s and inheriting all sorts of old weapon systems. Military in Australia, the army particularly, was very rarely funded well. It just didn't get what it needed. But it was a very simple form of warfare. It wasn't complex. The level of complexity just wasn't there yet. And then as technology particularly changed and the cabal started shifting to things like asymmetric warfare, as I said, with the Black September organization, with the terrorists, we had to start advancing our capabilities. The SAS developed its counterterrorism capability based largely on what the British had done. And then we developed it, as everyone did. They were the first, and they did a magnificent job, the Brit SAS 22, very good. But the rest of us have learned from them. And it's just become more and more complex and requires a higher level of intellect to really understand the game that's being played and then deliver a comprehensive capability to counter your adversary, because your adversary is playing at levels that when I was a young second lieutenant, that was like Star Trek, what we've got now. And again, it generally needs a high level of intellect, just brain power. Now, having served under a couple of US generals, you should be extremely proud of your flag rank generals. They are extraordinary. I've got to say this because these guys are just, they're hard and they are smart, like doctorate smart. Our generals, by and large, they'd be lucky to cut it as a major or a colonel. They're good staff officers. They're sort of poodle faking staff officers that know how to check the paperwork. But we don't have a general in our organization, not one that's a patch on a US general. And that's just simply because the standard of training is less, the experience is less, the exposure is less. And we're going to change that. That leads into our next question. how's our defense force going to look after this? Well, we're going to grow it dramatically, and we're going to arm it better than it's ever been armed. But on the basics, sea, air, land, special ops, cyber, and space capabilities, we're going to grow all of that. We're going to grow it organically. We're going to have our own. Yes, we'll certainly learn from everyone else, but in terms of military self-reliance, our objective is to be able to defend Australia and her interests absent any ally. No, never in our history have we had a defence force capable of that. And when I outlined this to the admirals, air marshals and generals, it's going to really shock them because they know how heavily we rely. Now, here's how, and it's embarrassment. I've deployed several times, not only with Australia, but elsewhere. And it's embarrassment. We turn up with no real logistics capability. We just plug into the US logistics system. Now, what does that do? We're incapable of sustaining ourselves. Now, literally, not a little secret, we had an operation in Timor, which was a cabal-driven operation to get the gas and oil from to the East Timorese. This is Timor's an island to our north. The Indonesians would never have handed it over unless they had a very compelling reason to allow East Timor to establish itself as an independent state, but they did. So I'm guessing the cabal paid off the Indonesian military. And it was a nonsense operation in the sense that it wasn't a real war. It was just designed to get a hold of the gas and oil. But it was a cluster. It was FUBAR. The airhead in Timor, in terms of the lack of logistics capability, and this is the point I'm making, we couldn't. The troops on the ground weren't getting what they needed. The resupplies, the stuff wasn't coming in. And so I was back in Sydney at the time, monitoring all of this in the headquarters of Australian Theatre. And the troops would be sending in, we haven't got our stuff yet. And the logisticians would say, but we sent it. Well, it's not here. Send it again. They were so incompetent. And this is a you don't air your dirty linen in public, but occasionally you do just to wake people up. The airhead at Dili, the city there, the airbase, was stacked with stuff and nobody knew what had arrived and what hadn't. The simple ability to receive stores and distribute it according to the operational demands, the OPDEMs, wasn't there. That's how incompetent the Australian Defence Force is. We are an embarrassment. When I finished, I had my last day in Kuwait, I was the liaison officer to the commander of the Combined Joint Task Force Kuwait for a while. And as on my last day, the Commander General said to me, I hope you've enjoyed your time with us, Rick. And I said, well, sir, I'm a bit despondent. And he looked at me quite concerned because American generals, they're good hosts. They know how to look after their allies, even though our contribution to that was a typographical error in the op order, let's be honest. It really was. And I said, no, you don't understand, sir. You've got more land-based firepower in your broken vehicle car park at the back of Camp Doha that we can muster on a good day. That's how embarrassing the Australian Defence Force is. It is. And so what are we going to do? Ladies and gentlemen of the Australian Defence Force, we will be capable of defending Australia and her interests independent of any ally. Now, what does that mean in real terms? Well, we're going to go from half a division, if we can muster that really in real terms, to having a deployable corps comprising three divisions. And this is land. I'll get to the others shortly. A corps of 100,000 comprising three divisions, including all the service, the combat support and service support they require. One division will be armoured, one division will be marine, and one division will be airborne. It's 100,000 shooters. On top of that, we're going to have, to support that, we're going to have two aircraft carrier groups, one east, one west. Now, we don't have that at the moment, but one east, one west. The Air Force, the Royal Australian Air Force, will, for the first time in its bloody life, spend its time defending and assisting naval and air ground assets. So we're going to be shifting the focus of the Air Force to assisting the ground and sea war. There will be air war, of course, but every time you spend another $150 million on an aircraft, they're saying, oh, we'll provide support to the sea and air, the sea and land battle. And they never do because they're always too busy doing something else because when you have so few aircraft, there's nothing to go around. As we were always taught, never bank on the Air Force turning up. Predicate your plan on no air support, which is a pretty childish sort of way of doing business. And people say to me, well, how can you get a corps when we can barely recruit enough now? Well, there's a couple of things there. One, the advertisements are, and without a word of a lie, the army recruiting is, it's got a picture of a female saying, do what you love. And so the hard men, you know, you need to actually fight wars are being recruited. So they're all not going. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't join either. Excuse me. But we had a corps of 100,000 in World War I when we had a population of 4 million. This is under General Sir John Monash. We had a corps of 100,000. And these are shooters. We're going to do the same with a population of 25.69 million. Now, we're going to have to shift the mentality of the people slightly to let them know that a defense force doesn't sit back and wait to get punched. The term we use is militarily intimidating. We want to be so intimidating that nobody comes anywhere near us. In fact, it reminds me of the Germanic tribes that faced the Romans. Now, the Germanic tribes were so wild, and they didn't even trade. All they did was ransack other tribes around them. But their measure of greatness was how far away the nearest tribe would come near them. Because if the nearest tribe was a mile away, well, you weren't terribly intimidating. If the nearest tribe was 5-10 miles away, then you had a good reputation because you were so fearsome. Now, we're going to trade. We're going to be good neighbors. But militarily, no one's going to come near us. And once again, there's a complete mind shift in terms of the military leadership. Get rid of the poodle-faking staff officers. Get some fighters in there. And I certainly intend to lean heavily on the US military, probably the Marines, to train up our senior officers to actually learn how to fight wars, because the training system you have in the US is for senior leadership is exemplary, fantastic. Ours is terrible. And so there's a bunch of elements of that. Now, why is this exciting? Because we're going to reestablish all our service support capabilities. As I said earlier, when we deploy, the logistics is take. We just plug into the US logistics. We need to get some tarmac space. We need to tap into your food and your fuel because it's better. We'll just turn up with a checkbook like all third world countries do, like they did in Afghanistan. I won't mention which one, but they turn up and say we want to operate out of CAF, Kandahar Air Base. And let's say, well, you haven't booked anything. Oh no, well, we've got a checkbook. We'll just pay you for tarmac space and fuel and parts, and it's just pathetic. That's what third world nations do. First world nations have their own capability. I've seen it at work. US is magnificent. And so we're going to reestablish all the supporting elements. Now, the reason we've got such a poor capacity for support is years ago, one of the governments decided that we can save money by reducing the teeth to tail ratio. For every shooter, you've got 10 people in the background folding blankets, you know, producing this and delivering that. Let's give that to private enterprise. They can do it much more efficiently. Well, what a lot of hogwash that was. All that happened was all those supporting requirements were outsourced to a company like Serco, which is a private company, which is owned by one of the British royal family. And all we do is it's a funnel of cash from the Australian people straight to Serco. Well, forget that. What we're going to do is we're going to reestablish a serious capability for our own independent self-reliant support, which means we are going to have more support people, and whether that means more butchers, more mechanics, more carpenters, you name it, we're going to have it. Chip designers, chip manufacturing, this is silicon chip. Shipbuilding, we are going to reestablish our shipbuilding capability in this country. Now, this is going to take time, I understand that, but our objective, once again, is to become self-reliant in defense. We need to be the best possible ally. We want to be the country that they say, the rest of the world, apart from maybe the US, comes to us and said, can you support us with this? We go, no problem. We've got two hospital ships ready to go. We've got the logistics capability to assist here. We've got the offensive capability to do that. And so they'll be coming to us saying, can you do it? We'll go, absolutely. And so we're going to expand the Defence Force. Once again, I'm saying this for the deadheads in Canberra, to be self-reliant in the defence of Australia and her interests. And that will send a shiver up the spine of everyone. And the first thing you'll hear is say, we can't do it. Yes, we bloody can. Yes, we can. We had a corps of 100,000 under Monash in the First World War. We're going to do it again, and we're going to have the best equipment. Initially, we'll be leaning heavily on the US defense industry, but after that, we're going to grow our own organic industries, every aspect of it. Now, can that be done? You bet. You remember when South Africa, and this is going back again for some of the older ones amongst you, remember during apartheid, South Africa was the pariah, the international pariah. No one would trade with South Africa. I'm not saying apartheid was good. That's just a circumstance. What South Africa did was, you're not going to trade with us. We'll build our own. And there was little South Africa building their own everything, and they're still selling to this day. We're going to do the same, and we're going to improve our capabilities in the support elements and grow it in the offensive elements, so we are genuinely self-reliant, and it's going to be extraordinarily exciting. So you imagine two carriers, one east-west, one east and one west, and you require all the air warfare destroyers, the subsurface and the surface vessels, and then the aircraft required to protect that battle, that carrier battle group. Can we do it? You bet we can. Where's the money coming from? Stop pissing it up against the wall for the United Nations. There's a start. Stop sending it over to the cabal. Because what the people of Australia don't understand is all the money that's been they've been taxed with is being going straight overseas. So the money's here. The capability is here. It'll take time, but we'll get up. The Australian Defence Force will be, in time, let me give you a realistic view, in time, probably in the top 5-7 militaries on the planet. And that's not without a word of a lie. We've got it. We're going to have it. It's going to be fantastic. Now, the benefit of all of that is we're going to grow the entire nation. You think about it. We are now producing more carpenters, more butchers, more electricians, more everything. We're growing. They spend some time in the military. They learn how to make a bed. They learn how to get out of bed on time, get to work, work hard, and we shape them psychologically. So we build a nation. And then they spend their minimum time in. They might spend, for example, you get a trade. The trade might take 3 or 4 years, depending on that. Then you'll do 3 years on the job and you can quit. And what happens is we are now feeding the Australian population with talented, skilled, hard, capable individuals, male and female, that know how to get stuff done. And they are practically skilled. And we will stop having surveys that reveal that, what is it? The Chinese were asked, the teenage kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they're saying things like astronauts. And in Australia, it was, I want to be a YouTube influencer. That's the greatest goal for young people in Australia, to be a YouTube influencer. Are you kidding me? That'll be gone. And we're not going to have conscription. Australians are traditionally very hard against conscription since the First War. They're happy to fight. We don't start them, but by Christ, we like finishing them. And that pugnacious attitude, we'll get it back. But the service with the Australian, I'm going to change the name. It's not going to be Australian Defence Force. It'll be Australian Military Forces. Because this idea of defence, well, let's not hit. Bullshit. If you need to punch first, you punch first. You need to break international law to send a team in and get something done. We'll do it. And we'll apologise later. So the Australian Military Forces will be the means by which the country is grown and the capability is grown. And we're going to have smart, tough people with real skills that'll continue to grow. It's just going to be extraordinary. Shipbuilding, you name it, every aspect of defense, and the money will be spent. It's going to be spent anyway. So why not spend it at home training up our own people? It's going to be brilliant. And one more benefit, you finish your time with the defense force, with the military, Australian military forces. You get in, do your job, get skilled, whatever it might be, get a trade, get out. You'll be granted as a priority. I'm still going to do the maths on this, but let's call it an acre of land, and that'll be your land. Just like in the old days when the soldiers came back, they got a land grant, and the same thing will happen because we need to start repopulating the rural areas. So we'll be allocating large areas of land around country towns that have been stripped of their population because of the concentration in the big cities by design. Again, cabal wants to strip the land of its people. We're going to repopulate the countries. And so you have towns like Lithgow and Bathurst and Wagram, names that mean nothing to you, but these towns are now going to grow and they're going to get the infrastructure they need. And so the whole plan is not just to have a good military that can defend the country. The whole plan is to grow the entire nation. So we create a capable nation of individuals that have served their country. And once a soldier, always a soldier. You know that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But it'll be so attractive. They'll want to join. Their parents will tell them to join, they'll get through, and they'll get out. And so in a typical special ops way, we pull two or three strings, we get a big strategic effect. So not only do we build our economy, not only do we build the people, but we build the entire country and the spirit and the morale and that national characteristic that we have as Australians to do what's got to be done. Excuse me, my dog is just... Can you get the dog out, please, sweetie? Thank you. Sorry about that. No, he's not getting out. I think he's sick of me talking. So, just one moment.
No, that's fine.
Okay, we're good.
No, that's fine.
So, I just, no, just, just to wrap that up, the military will have a very hard, focused job to do, but it's also not a social development process. It's just service in the military does something to you. It makes you better than you were, without a doubt. And for those of you who think this is a military box head thing, Socrates, one of the three greatest philosophers upon which Western civilization is built, was a brave soldier. So guess what? You can be smart and hard. It's not one or the other. In the 21st century in Australia, you got to be both.
That all sounds good to me. And once they get switched and changed down there in Australia and you shape them up, I'll definitely be coming out there to take a vacation, because my wife has really been wanting to come out there for a while. And once it gets fixed, we'll definitely be coming out there.
Brilliant.
And with that, Bozy, I'll hand it all over to my admin, JW, and we can go into Q&A if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. Let's have some fun.
Hi, Bozy. Thanks so much for coming back. Love having you. First up, we're going to have Elvorno, and after Elvorno, Wanda. And for anyone that doesn't know, when you need to ask your question, when you're called on, click that tap to unmute, that microphone in the middle to unmute yourself and ask your question. So, Elvorno, you're up.
We can move on to Wanda.
All right, Wanda, you're up.
Hello, sir. Good to be able to talk to you. I want to thank you for your service. Being a veteran, it means a lot to me to be able to talk to you. What do you think is going to happen to all the territories, like American Samoa, Guam, the Virgin Islands, you know, all of our territories and stuff? What's going to happen to them?
I don't know exactly, but if I were in President Trump's position, I'd be hanging on to them for grim death. Because owning a piece of territory in some distance from home is always useful. They're good staging bases. It helps keep people honest. So I'd be hanging on to them. The degree to which they continue their independence, because, as you know, the U.S. territories have a limited degree of independence, but I'd certainly be hanging on to those. In the short term, long term, that's a separate question. But right now, that's the smart way to play it, because this will take time to transition an entire globe from one way of living to another. So what might happen years from now, difficult to predict, but right now the smart play would be to hang on to it, continue to use those to your advantage, even if it seems geographically odd to have these territories so far from continental US, it is a massively useful strategic advantage, particularly as we still have adversaries out there that wish us harm. So as things settle down, that might change. But right now, hang on to them. Leave them as they are in terms of their status. And down the track, we'll see.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I have a vested interest. My husband's from American Samoa. So I kind of have a vested interest in especially American Samoa that, you know, that we hang on to that and he doesn't, you know, have to leave. But he served 30 years in the military. So, you know, I think that, you know, he should be able to stay here in the United States. And, you know, he fought for the United States. So I think he should be able to stay here.
I think so, too. That's my personal view.
Okay, Laura, you're up. And after Laura, Pam Timms.
Good morning, Ricardo. Nice to see you and to hear some morning. Words.
He just wandered back in.
I'm very happy to be able to ask this in a chat that's being recorded. Would you please discuss how you feel the Australians are going to cope with being the 51st state of the United States? You know, I'm in a lot of the groups and I see people saying that, you know, they're a bit still anti-American. I appreciate that you know the score on all this. I'm trying to be careful how I phrase this. What's your game plan for winning the hearts and minds? Until we can have our constitutional convention here and Also, how do you see three-letter agencies going forward? Like, I know we won't have an ASIO. How are you going to organize intelligence? Will that just be another arm of the military? Thanks, Rick.
Sure. Yeah, no pleasure. You nailed the actual question. How do we win the hearts and minds of the Australians? Because whichever way we advance, we need the support of the people. This is what's known as the center of gravity for every military operation. The center of gravity is that one aspect that you must have control of, without which you have no chance of success. And in a Western democracy, the center of gravity is always the support of the people, always. And so that's what has to be done. Nobody, me included, enjoys being barked at. After a quarter of a century of taking orders from imbeciles, I'm done. You know, if I don't consent, you better come armed and bring the body bags because you're going to need them, because I'm no fan of being told what to do either. So the hearts and minds, how do we win the hearts and minds over the next short period of time to help people understand? Well, point number one, when the revelations come out in detail, even the most hardline resistor will know that something has to change, because the depth of depravity of what has occurred under our current leaderships is so awful that it'll shock them into silence. And I think I said it before, I intend to do a series of tours around the country, and it'll be a 12-part tour. And like when I did the Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney tour, part one, part two, part three, each talk was on a different subject, but it was one comprehensive piece of work, if you follow me. What I'll be doing is the revelations will come out, the people will be shocked, they're going to want an answer, and I can provide that answer. And so I'll be doing a 12-part tour around the country. And this is regardless of anybody else. This is regardless of the white hats, whatever. This is going ahead anyway. And so we'll go around to the capital cities and the major centers, and it'll be part one through part 12, describing what we're going to create, how we're going to create it, and what it means in the broad, and then the detailed policy terms. Now, how do I know that's going to work? Because everyone has different priorities. Some are focused on the morality of this country. How can we have full-term abortion and issues like that? And so we outline that. Others are more set on the sovereignty. You know, we want to control ourselves, and we're sick to death of being told by other people what we want to do. And there's the growing patriot movement. And that word in Oz has not been in common usage ever, but it is now. And so a lot of people are keen on the sovereignty issue, and we've got plans for that, detailed policy plans. Self-reliance. Our manufacturing, for example, and I alluded to this during the talk on the answer to the military, our self-reliance has collapsed in every way. And self-reliance goes from the family through to the economy and manufacturing, let's say, and defense of the nation at the very top. That is of importance to some. And you work down, and everyone has their own particular interest. By the end of this 12-city tour, the whole country will have seen the truth will have come out. I don't need to spend much time defining the problem. The problem will be abundantly clear to even the most blind. But what they'll be desperate for is the answer. And we're the only organization that has been working for years now on a comprehensive plan. There's lots of detail at the bottom end to sort out, but a comprehensive plan to cover what we want this country to be. And for those of you who haven't heard this, this is our end state, and this is military planning. In fact, I'll give you the full intention, because this helps answer the question, how do we win their hearts and minds? We're the only organization that has a clear view of how we want the future to be. Now, you might agree and disagree. You might violently disagree and want to set up an opposing position. 10 out of 10, go for it. We have no problem with that, but this is our view. Now, when the military establishes its intention, it comprises three parts: purpose, method, end state. The purpose is what we're going to do. And our purpose always has to be a short, sharp statement that everyone can remember. And our purpose is to save Australia. It has been for years. We set this up a long time ago. The method. Now, this is key as well. And this explains the involvement of everybody in this country. The method is this: that we will create a moral political party which assists every Australian to reach their highest individual potential, so collectively all can participate in the reformation of Australia. Now, that's never been tried before. It is the most difficult approach, yet it is the only one that will guarantee that what we are facing now will never happen again. Because by engaging everybody, by making this everybody's responsibility, to whatever degree they can contribute, is key to our success. Now, what's our end state? Our end state's very simple. Australia is a moral, sovereign, self-reliant Christian Western democracy, which is economically powerful, militarily intimidating, politically free, culturally vibrant, and socially cohesive. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're creating. And if somebody wants to throw up a counter, and I mean it, good luck to them, go for it. But that's our view of the country. And I am certain that after the truth is revealed, and it'll come through mainstream media, and it'll come from the same mainstream media that have been lying to us for decades, because it has to, the people will realize, my God, what do we do next? Fortunately, we've been working now for 4 years on what we do next. And by the end of this 12-city tour, the whole country, I mean, following part one, part two, part three, part four, and by the time we get to part 12, we'll have enough of the country saying, absolutely, this is the way to go. Because it's not just what we're going to do, it's how we're going to do it. We are devolving authority, political authority and power to the lowest possible level. And once they get a hold of that and they realize the implications of that, they will feel confident and comfortable that this is not a cover for a dictatorship. This is a temporary period that has to clean out the muck. This is one of the Herculean tasks, the cleaning of the Augean stables. And if you don't know that story, it's worth looking up and how Hercules solved it. The cleaning of the Augean stables before we hand the country to the people, but have the systems in place that they can slip straight in and realize this is fantastic. From counties to a redistribution of the states, because we have very few concentrated states. We're going to have at least 9 to push that authority as far down as possible, make it hard for any subsequent tyrant to try to take over this country. And so in answer to your question, two parts. Reveal the truth. That'll shock them into awareness. And then we provide the plan for them and the detail of which they get to contribute to. But they see the plan and they see where we're heading. And once we get that, as I said, we won't have everybody. And that's okay. You'll never get everybody, but we'll have enough. And we'll have enough to say, yeah, this is the only way forward because there is no alternative. And I love to do that. I get peppered with questions a lot. And that's a good thing. And I stand there. I've mentioned it before. I did a talk in Melbourne, Princess Park in Melbourne, stood on a stage in the sun. I think it was about 4.5 hours and another hour and a half afterwards, just allowing people to, you know, metaphorically poke me in the chest and ask every hard question just to see if I'm real or I'm just another smiling face on a screen. Well, I'm real as, and they know it. And that's why the A1 supporters, regardless whether they like my style or not, or whether they like me or not, they know that I'm sincere, then we're going to deliver this and we're going to hand the country to the people. So I'm quite relaxed about that process, given the opportunity to do this 12-city tour and outline the plan and let people make up their own mind. By the end of it, watch this space, folks. It's going to be fantastic. In terms of the agencies, the intelligence agencies, like every other aspect of life in Australia, they've been utterly penetrated by Masonic filth. Absolutely penetrated. There'll be a cleaning of every aspect of Australian leadership, and that's why Australia is such a put upon country, because every aspect, the polity, the bureaucracy, the judiciary, the military, the constabulary, big business, big unions, academia, media, every church, synagogue, mosque, lodge, and temple, all penetrated by the Masonic filth. That needs to be wiped out. That is a preliminary operation that must be done. They've got to be removed. And you know, people say, well, how do you do that? Well, it's actually not that hard. And let's get serious. Let's get down to battalion level. That's quite low in the military, battalion level. Every CO is probably a Masonic filth. So you sack them and you promote the second in command and say, right, you got 6 months. And if you prove to be the least bit Masonic, you're going to be sacked too. We can promote instead of having company commanders as majors, let's say, well, captains in there and battalion commanders as majors. It'll work. They're smart. They can do it. So we can literally take the top layer off the Defence Force and the military and the intelligence agencies and every other aspect. You just slice them off because that's where your problem lies. Lock them up for terrorism, under terrorism charges, because they're all guilty. It appears they're all guilty of terrorism charges under our current laws because of what they've done and taking an oath to another entity and acting in either a political or ideological or religious bias to cause terror. So every constable in this country, every police, they're done. They're actually guilty. So slice off that top layer, throw them out, and get everybody to step up. Now, is it going to be messy? Yeah. Mistakes are going to be made? Absolutely. But these are the birth pains of a nation that is coming to political maturity for the first time in its history. And we accept that and we understand that, and that's okay. As long as the errors aren't catastrophic, we'll be okay. And let's face it, intelligence agencies, we haven't kept a secret worth a damn since they were established. They're all penetrated. They're handing over information to the Masonic filth. Is it up to the cabal? They're all guilty. So how can we, what deficit are we going to suffer if the intelligence agencies are cleaned out? Zero. In fact, at least we're not losing information. We might not be collecting it, but at least we're not losing it at a rapid rate. So this is the depth of the problem. So once you realize the best way to do is just get a scalpel and slice off that top layer, lock them up, and get everyone back to work. You watch them. I know the Australian character better than most. We are not like the Americans. We are rude. We are rough. But we can rip the Band-Aid off in one strip and get on with it. We just want to get on with it. That's us. And we're going to do it. We'll be okay. You know, of that, I'm impatiently waiting for that opportunity. The time's not quite right yet, but it will be. Because I know we're ready to go. And that's one of the joys of working in the Defence Force for a quarter of a century. I get to live and work with men and women from all walks of life. See, when you're a judge, you live and work with the judiciary. When you're a cop, you live and work with the constabulary. And you get to see bad things, but you know, that leadership group. But the best part of being a leader in the military is living and working with men and women from all over the place. You learn so much about the national character. And so I know we can do it. I really do. I have no doubts Australia can do it, but we've got to do it an Australian way. We're a different country. we might speak the same language, but man, we are different, but we're good. We'll do it.
Well, just before I go, I just want to say thank you to you for not just being an amazing leader, but one who walks beside us and one who inspires us to take our roles as leaders in our communities. And I just want to thank you so much, you and Rhiannon both, for the amazing examples you are to us all.
Absolute pleasure. No additional charge, all included in the price of admission.
Thanks, Rick.
Okay, Pam, you're up now, and then after Pam will be Oath Keeper. Pam Timms. Okay, Oath Keeper, you can go next.
Nope. Oh, there he is. Colonel, how are you, sir? Thank you.
Sorry about that. I just had family noises. Okay, how are you doing?
Doing very well, and thank you for this opportunity. What a pleasure to be in the presence of this. And I'd like to thank Mike as well. Mike has been a go-getter, absolute charger in this movement. And thank you, Mike, for this opportunity as well. I got a question out of what I'm about to say, so forgive me if it sounds a bit off. I've got 25 veterans who have made me kind of the spokesperson in some PTSD groups. We all pick on it in some of our own malice ways, you know, because we're like, who the hell doesn't have PTSD? But anyway, but we have to do the veteran thing and get these groups together and stuff. So we turned the groups about 3 years ago into intel groups. So whenever we get in the groups, we just talk about intel. We talk about what did we hear? What did we learn? Whatever. We understand the Third Reich, and this old World War II vet, he's like, he stands up and says, God damn it, War II isn't even over yet. And how he explained things to us, you know, we're like, son of a bitch, he's right, in a sense. We have a question. I say we, our group. There's this gentleman by the name of David Carlson and his wife, Sarah Carlson. He comes by the name King David off Telegram. A year ago, he had a interview with Dr. Charlie Ward. Now, he come across saying that he is civilian commander-in-chief. I don't know if you've heard of such a thing. It dumbfounded one of our fellows, and we tried to do a little bit of research on it because we want the truth. We want to know who to listen to, who not to listen to. And can you please let your wife know, thank you for replying to me on Facebook, on the Telegram. What a sweet lady for taking the time to answer my question, and I do appreciate it. So basically, the truther movement. Just keep doing what we're doing, or do you have some direction in respect to this David Carlson by chance?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Who do we trust? That's a tough one. I can tell you who I trust. I trust President Donald J. Trump. I trust General Mike Flynn. So that's not because I like him, and not because I dedicated my book to Donald Trump, which I did. Our intel feeds come from all sorts of sources, outside of the U.S. And so we put our money strongly on Donald J. Trump and General Mike Flynn. Now, having said that, there are a lot of people who have appeared on Charlie Ward's show, and I wonder sometimes why he puts them on, because he's had people saying, you know, I'm the lawful king of this, and I'm the president of that, and whatever. And I think to myself, okay, I guess what he's doing is he's just allowing people to make their statements. But if you follow Derek Johnson, and he's very careful and assiduous attention to detail on the difference between the federal government and the military is two separate entities, and there's a separate role between commander-in-chief and president. And if you follow the rules, that's the best way to go. I've heard a lot of people saying, I'm the queen of this and I'm the king of that. And my answer is very simply this. I didn't consent to any of that, so I don't care what piece of paper you've got. And just to be clear on this, this applies to the common law movement, and it applies to the Magna Carta movement, and it applies to all these people that think they can wave a piece of paper and go, this gives me authority to tell you what to do. And I just sit back quietly, as I did, not so quietly, when I was charged and had to appear in the court of South Australia. I was in a separate state at the time, so I appeared by on screen. But I didn't wear a mask, and I was charged, and I had to appear. And I made a statement, and the magistrate got on the phone, and he said, right, and I recorded this. He said, now, what are you going to do? You're going to plead? Are you going to do this? And I said, I'm going to make a statement, and then I'm going to hang up. And the short version was, is I stand under no man or woman, nor class of man or woman, to take orders from anybody. I consented to none of this. I'm a free man, and until you get my consent, you can go to hell. I don't care how many wigs and black robes you wear. So nobody in my mind has power over me. Now, they can kill me, but I'm not going to consent to any of this stuff. And so getting back to your question, who do you trust? If anybody claims to be something, they can claim all they want. I just ignore everybody. In our country, for example, we have no lawful government because the Constitution has been so abused that we know that they are unconstitutional. We behave ourselves and we act as if they are, but we know they're not, because we act as if they are because we need to avoid anarchy and move to a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, which we intend to create. So in the meantime, these characters that present themselves as the Queen of Canada, the King of this, I just ignore them because I didn't vote and I didn't consent. And I remember there was a woman, we had the massive rallies where millions turned up in Canberra in protest to all of this, and a woman was literally screaming in my face, Article 61, Article 61 of Magna Carta, say it, Article 61, literally yelling at me. Article 61 gives us, King John, this is King John, Magna Carta, King John of England, gave the people the right to lawful rebellion. And I tried to explain to her that I don't need some half-assed king in a country 800 years ago telling me I can tell you to get stuffed. I've got that right, courtesy of God. And if I don't like what you're saying, you can go to hell. And that applies to Magna Carta. Now, having said all of that, there's some lovely history that we can draw upon, and we can draw upon Magna Carta and the common law. They're great things. But nobody's the right to tell me to do anything but God, end of story. And so if anybody tries it and, you know, claims, I just ignore them. We've had so many people claiming to be this and claiming to be that, and I'm this and I'm that, and I don't care. I just don't care. We get on with the job. We know what our end state is. And as a serviceman, you'll know. And this is one of my...
Hallelujah, Colonel. I appreciate that very much. As a matter of fact, Jerry Johnson, the father of Derek, him and I have been in communication. He used to be stationed in Plattsburgh Air Force Base, and I worked on aircraft that are still in there. And so that's where him and I started communicating. And his son is actually somebody who has saved a couple of my veteran friends' lives due to how he was able to bring it right down, dumbed it right down, and us veterans are like, oh, shit. You know, we could not believe we didn't recognize it at first, you see. But it tells the story. Everything that Derek Johnson has verbalized is factual. We can find it. We can locate it. We can read it. So that's the route we have been taking. Some of our fellas that like to help go into different groups sometimes, and we say we have to have the tangible evidence in order to know. So we've been going the Derek Johnson route. I call it the Derek Johnson route just due to how he awakened us to it. And as well as your thrust with God, no matter what choice I make, as long as it's a choice from God, they take my life is one thing. It doesn't matter. I'm still justified. But Colonel, thank you for your time. And it really solidified what we were thinking. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Okay, Stephen, you're up next.
It's Stefan. It's not Stephen, but that's all right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bozzi, for your speech, and it gives a lot of hope. I'm calling from Europe. I know that you guys are in Australia. I was wondering if you have some contact, some people we can talk to, like you, the Ricardo Bozzi from Europe or from France. I'm French, by the way.
Comment ça va?
Très bien, merci beaucoup. Il est très tôt le matin.
Okay, the best I can give you, I have no particular contacts in Europe. The best suggestion I can make, and I say this with all sincerity, is do what a gentleman in Scotland did. He went to our website, had a look at various aspects, and said, we need the same here in Scotland. And he's establishing a group called Scotland One. This requires every one of us to start from a homegrown perspective. And that's it. So I've got nobody in Europe with whom we are liaising, so I can't give you a name, but just start. And I mean it. France One, in English anyway. But just start it. We'll be, as we finalize, and there have been delays, and that's been okay, with our constitution and our rules and the rest, we're happy to share that with the world. Think of it as a no-cost franchise. You can look at what we've done, adapt it for your own country, and start creating it, because it is predicated on the sovereignty of the people, a moral, sovereign, self-reliant people. And so that resonates with everybody. The French have been doing a fantastic job of standing up and just communicating their utter displeasure, which is a nice way to say it, their utter displeasure, Stefan, with what's been going on. And we've taken much comfort from watching the French protests. We really have, because it's nice to know there are others that are risking life and limb for good. So the best advice, I'm sorry I have no contacts, but certainly look at what we're doing. If you like it, adapt it for your own country and start. Because, look, I never saw myself in this position. And my wife and I, we're just, you know, my previous life was very comfortable and very nice. And we never imagined we'd be where we are. And that goes for just about everybody in Australia One. We had one brilliant state coordinator. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, she didn't even know the Australian Prime Minister. That's how little of interest she was in politics. And she became one of our best state coordinators. And so everyone has to become somebody new. So I'm not sure what your background is, Stefan, but step up, do it yourself, and just go and see what happens.
Thank you. Thank you for answering. I understand. But to be very honest, for the moment, I'm staying a little bit under the radar, as we can say. You asked about my background. I'm in the pharmaceutical industry. I'm a manager.
Okay.
And yeah, I have nobody to talk to. I'm completely out of what the people are thinking of. And to be honest, I'm not sure that if I raise my voice or if I start to do something that I'm not going to be jailed or put aside and have a very difficult life. I'm being honest. And so that's why I was wondering if there are some people in Europe where we can start to talk to each other and start something together. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Thank you very much.
I don't see any other hands up, Mike. So it looks like back to you, unless anyone else has a question. You want to press that middle button to raise your hand.
Thanks, JW. And Ricardo, I want to thank you for joining us. It looks like we're out of questions, and you gave us a lot of good packed information. And would love to have you back on again anytime.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Honestly, just give us a bell. Look, we'll make ourselves available. We are now reaching a time where we have to be very adaptive and respond quickly, because so much will be happening that the people are going to need good information on the way ahead, what's happening and what's not. So anytime you like, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ricardo. And I'll send you the recording when it's all uploaded. Thank you, boss.